But now Kerris Matthews uncovers a sacred choral tradition. The Sacred Harp is a songbook of Christian hymns. Popular in the southern states around the time of the Civil War, it's currently experiencing a global resurgence. Kerris travels to Alabama in Songs of the Sacred Harp.
It's early morning, but it's hot already. Loads of trees and green rolling hills, the odd pond or lake, and little houses dotted along the small country road that we're travelling down. Now, I've been invited to attend an all-day singing convention, and I'm going to read you the email that I got before I came out. It says I'm going to get the real, organic, authentic US Southern tradition in its original context. It's something that we think of as very precious and very much endangered. He goes on to say, there are not many British or Europeans who, for their first ever all-day sacred harp singing, attend one of the remaining strong, old-timey, small church singings. The singing will be very powerful. You may be a little taken aback. And the people here already looking very excited.
I heard the music and I stood up from my chair and I said, what is this? This sounds like hillbillies singing choral English church music.
The sacred harp is a term for the combination of human voices as we sing. There's no musical accompaniment, so the entire sound is produced by the voice, which is the harp.
When you're one of 100, 200 people who are singing together, who are in time, who are in rhythm, who are singing the same words, it's a completely overwhelming, explosive feeling.
It's about as close to God as you can get. It's a good time. It's a religious thing for me.
Turn o'er my pillow once again and kiss my fevered cheek. I'll soon be freed from all the pain, for now I am so weak.
I grew up singing hymns. But there's something about sacred harp music which is just a little bit strange. Once called white spiritual, its heartland is here in Alabama and the surrounding states. And for the last two centuries, it's been preserved pretty much unchanged in communities around little rural Protestant churches, very much like the one I'm at today. The area's known as the Bible Belt, and my first impression is of a mainly older, white crowd. But things are changing. Singing schools are opening up in the northern states, in the UK, Ireland and Germany, and many of the new generation of singers aren't at all religious. So why this fresh interest in these archaic hymns when church attendance in general is dropping? And what does this change mean for the original communities?
When I was a child growing up in school, they all made fun of me, said I was sang the old book singing.
Reba Del Windham is the organizer of today's event.
Most young people didn't do it back when I was going to school, back in the 50s. See, I'm letting you know how old I am. But they did sort of make fun of us.
You're the leader today?
Yes.
Are you going to be running the whole show?
Pretty much. But everyone is willing to help.
How about the songs? Who decides on the songs?
The leaders. Each leader has a turn in the square. And they have their choice of which one they want to sing.
I'm a beginner, an absolute beginner.
Well, that's great. You'll love it.
Am I going to lead today?
If you want to. All you got to do is sign a card and say that you will lead.
Do you think I should?
Should lead? It's fantastic in the square, hon. It's great. Yes, I think you should.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Inside the small wooden church, chairs are arranged in rows, with each vocal part facing into the middle to make a hollow square.
We have always, usually, at our sing-ins and conventions, started with one particular song, which is 59, and Holy Manna is the name of it. And in the song, the words are, "Brethren, we have met to worship," which is really a good song to open with, I think.
The opening number is followed by a prayer. To an outsider like me, all this suggests a heavily religious practice, and yet it's non-denominational. You don't have to follow any belief system to be here.
This happens to be in a church building, and it's on Sunday, but the church that meets here is dismissed.
Warren Steele is professor of music at the University of Mississippi and an authority on this music's pioneers back in 18th century New England.
William Billings was a tenor. He conducted music in the local churches and taught in a fairly small area from Rhode Island to Maine, but mostly around Boston. They said he had a very loud voice and one leg shorter than the other and was taking great handfuls of snuff. He was very interested in poetry, with a lot of spirit, not necessarily a lot of taste. So he was not exactly a cultivated figure, but people respected him for his musical abilities.
What were the role of preachers in all this?
Much like here today in the South, it was to their advantage to have good singing in church. And so they helped set up singing schools for the benefit of church singing, and which in that time didn't have musical instrument to support it. They were providing music for singing in church. But once they had more than 12 or 15 tunes, the singers really wanted to do more than that and sing a little bit more elaborate music and anthems and these fuguing tunes. And so it kind of outgrew in some ways the church, but it was still the staple of church music. And they talk about these fuguing entries going around the upper gallery in the meeting house like a dog chasing its tail.
Back then, most people couldn't read music, and so preachers had to spoon-feed parts to their congregations, which meant hymns often ended up as slow dirges. To teach more complex songs, they needed a new form of notation, and they came up with a system where the notes fa, sol, la, and mi were given differently shaped heads, which they called shape notes. To this day, all sacred harp songs are sung first with these sounds. To get my head around shape notes, I went for a lesson with singing teacher and scholar Jesse Carlsberg.
Sacred harp singing follows its own rules of harmony that are quite different from classical music. There was a man by the name of Charles Seeger, who was a musicologist, folklorist. He wrote an article about sacred harp singing in 1940, and he was just fascinated with it because he looked at a bunch of these songs and he saw, oh my goodness, this breaks just about every rule that we have in our book of Western tonal theory or whatever it is. Let's see, we have the parts cross each other. We have discords that just, you know, happen in the course of two voices, you know, moving in a certain direction. Our music's written melodically, so if two parts should intersect at a time and create a discord, that's considered okay in our music.
Oh,
what people notice about the composition is that the voice parts, that each one is melodic. It's not just making an accompaniment. And it's supposed to be fun to sing, no matter whether you're singing alto, treble, or bass, as well as the tenor, which is the melody.
Past 10 now, so yeah, we sang for an hour. We're having a little break. We're all sort of surrounding the coffee urn. It's actually reminded me a lot of chapel, singing in chapel. And there's some familiar tracks as well, like you could have heard a bit of, the Christmas carol, that one. So it doesn't feel as strange as I thought it might feel, actually.
That the songs of the Sacred Harp sound familiar to the British ear isn't actually so surprising. Jesse Carlsberg.
There's a bunch of songs in the book that were added probably in the 19th century that take melodies that actually go, in a lot of cases, straight back to England or Ireland or Scotland, centuries and centuries back. And so when Southern tune book compilers were putting together books like the Sacred Harp and the Southern Harmony, a lot of these books in the mid-19th century, they took all these great tunes and often for the very first time set them down on paper.
One song that people really love, the most famous one I think in this book, is called New Britain, otherwise known as Amazing Grace. It's been interpreted many, many ways, but the lyrics are first set to the tune in shape notes singing songbooks.
That's correct. Actually, a lot of people are like, why isn't it called Amazing Grace? Most of our songs are actually, the names that appear above them are tune names. And New Britain tells that story really well because John Newton wrote this hymn in 1779. The first appearance of the tune in a songbook was in 1829, and it appears with a different text. So you have the words without the music, and you also have the music without the words. And it's in a book called The Southern Harmony, published in 1835, that William Walker took John Newton's hymn and set it to this tune that we now think of as Amazing Grace.
When people hear the Sacred Harp version of Amazing Grace, they'll be quite surprised at the sort of relentless quality of the melody.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds quite different, minimal and spare. We also sing it often at a pretty brisk clip, and we sing it at a steady rhythm. So often people will, you know, kind of let the melody spread out or drag out or will hold out certain notes, but we just go right through it, you know. You can very clearly see if you come to a Sacred Harp singing that we're not singing with vibrato, we're not singing quietly, we're not singing with a contained or closed up voice. At Sacred Harp singings, we sing with a full kind of open sound, and it is a kind of release. But the way that I've thought of it is that it's almost a release from the difficult conditions of life. In the 1850s, 1860s here in Alabama and Georgia, where so many Sacred Harp singers were cotton farmers. They were involved in this really back-breaking, intensive labor, and the only time when you probably weren't working was when you were sleeping or when you're eating dinner at night, or then after dinner maybe you go out and sing on your porch. And if you think about the hymn texts that we have in the Sacred Harp, that so many of them are about, a better world on high, you know, or I'm going to a better land.
Yeah.
Or my soul shall quit this mortal veil. Even the words that you're singing reflect the intense difficulty of life.
Why should we start in fear to die? What timorous worms we mortals are. Death is the gate to endless joy, and yet we dread to enter there. I'm Henry Johnson. I live in Center, Alabama. One of the things newcomers sometimes remark upon is how often we sing of death. And we sing of death from different perspectives. A couple of the texts speak simply of the nearness of death to all of us. Let me read you another one. My soul, come meditate the day and think how near it stands when thou must quit this house of clay and fly to unknown lands. And you, mine eyes, look down and view the hollow gaping tomb. This gloomy prison waits for you whene'er the summons come. That's not a hopeful text. That is a sobering text. In other songs, death is the gate to endless joy.
My name is Emma Rose Brown, and I'm 21 years old. I think in nowhere else in my life have I been asked to think about death in the same way that I have with Sacred Harp. And so it doesn't frighten me or anything. I appreciate it, and I'm able to do thinking that I wouldn't normally be able to do.
I'm going home to Christ above. I'm going to the Christian's rest, to die no more, to die no more. I'm going home to die no more.
At midday we break for a picnic lunch.
This is part of saying most people enjoy the most.
Meatballs, barbecued chicken. This is zucchini, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a chicken casserole or
yeah, it's got cornflakes on the top.
Okay, yes, it does.
What's this one with the croquettes on the top?
Tater tot casserole. It has hamburger meat and cream of mushroom soup, cream of celery soup.
It all tastes better than it sounds.
As a music lover, the American Deep South has always had a strong pull for me. Blues, gospel, and Negro spirituals all come from around here. But there's an obvious difference. Most, though not all, of the singers here are white. So why this divide? Scholar and singing teacher Jesse Carlsberg.
Sacred Harp singing has a long history of black and white singing in the South. You know, after the Civil War, it was a good 30 or 40 years before a lot of the Jim Crow laws came into effect that kind of enforced racial segregation. In the period before that, there were singings that brought white and black people together. In the early 20th century, singings became segregated. So throughout the 20th century, you had black Sacred Harp singings and white Sacred Harp singings, but without hardly any overlap. And particularly after World War II, cotton farming collapsed. People had to move to cities or they in droves. In that period, white singers could travel and support each other's singings all across the state and even across state lines. And black singers, I think, in a lot of ways, it wasn't safe for them to do that. And I think because of that, those singings have aged a lot more. So there's not a lot of black singers who are still active.
In the 1970s, Sacred Harp singing began expanding beyond its traditional home in the South, with conventions in northern universities and a concerted effort to welcome people regardless of race or creed. One of the people driving this change is now in his 80s. He's here today.
I'm here with Mr. Hugh McGraw, and we've already sung some of your songs. You've actually got songs in the book.
I've got eight in the book. It's a form of worship. But the main thing is the fellowship that we get of visiting one another. If these Sacred Harp singers see some of these people tomorrow that are singing, they'll hug their neck again because they're so glad to see them.
In the last decade or so, Sacred Harp has spread beyond the United States, with singing communities all over Europe, including many in the UK. In Neasden, North London, 20 or so singers meet each month. So, with no direct link with the communities of the Deep South, what connects them to the music?
My name's Sam Carter and I am 29. I live my life, you know, next to a computer, speaking to people via email all day long. You know, it's that community thing that really grabs people with Sacred Harp. It just kind of draws you in. It's a physical thing, singing. It's not just sound. It feels completely physical. And doing that with a bunch of people, even when you know, I don't necessarily know all the people here tonight, but there's something very personal about sharing that.
Many of those who are new to Sacred Harp singing in the UK and the US aren't practicing Christians, which raises some difficult questions.
My name's Jackie, I'm 66. I'm an atheist, and these words are very religious, but I've always been a depressive and I've often felt suicidal. And I've tried to explain to people that this is a reassurance that I will cope.
My name's Angus MacLeod, I'm age 60. It's for the release, actually. It feels like therapy. And it's not to do with the faith, it's simply to do with the singing. Collective howling at the moon.
I once had a Southern Baptist ask me, why do you sing this music if you don't believe in the words? And I think that there's a misconception that because so many of these words are either based on the doctrines of Christianity or have to do specifically with Jesus Christ or God, that you cannot find a way to align yourselves with their morals and their understandings. And I find that the lyrics of these songs quite frequently apply to any person who considers themselves one who does good works, which to me is ultimately a Christian.
The poetry is strikingly eloquent, even for people who are not religious or are not Christian. And there are quite a few Jewish people and simply non-religious people that are very enthusiastic Sacred Harp singers, and they still appreciate the poetry.
Cyrus Matthews, followed by Loretta Smith.
Back in Alabama, at the start of the day, I put my name down to lead a song. Finally, the moment comes.
Same opening, bottom.
Bottom piece, 29.
You stood in the hollow square, all eyes at you. Your back, your sides, your front. What's she gonna do?
The song I've chosen is Tribulation. Goes like this. Death, 'tis a melancholy day to those who have no God, when the poor soul is forced away to seek her last abode. In vain to heaven she lifts her eyes, for guilt, a heavy chain still drags her downward from the skies to darkness, fire, and pain.
It's like one of those occasions where you know you have to speak in public or do something in public and you know your name's going to be called. So somebody was called just before me, Carolyn or something, and I'm like, that's me. Because I wasn't exactly sure how it would go, whether I'd pick the right tempo or remember what to do with my arm. And then there's a fella there with a moustache. I guess he's one of the most famous faces of Sacred Harp singing. So he was right there staring, making sure I was doing right. But no, it's all right. It went okay. Enjoyed it. And then after that, they had like the 5-year-old come up after me and the 4-year-old, and I guess if they did it, I could do it too.
Now's time for announcements.
There's two singings listed in the minutes for next Sunday. One was the one you heard in Georgia. And the other one's across the state in Fayette County. We expect to see 50% of you over there.
Before I came out here, I was warned that this southern tradition is endangered, and looking around, it's fair to say most of the people here are from the older generation. But with this new global interest, why should it matter if numbers are falling here? Historian Warren Steele.
Buell Cobb, who wrote a book on Sacred Harp in 1978, said something that's a kind of a warning, and he says it doesn't matter if students in Cambridge or Berkeley are fascinated with this music, if young people in Tallapoosa or Haleyville are not finding anything in it. In other words, that in many parts of the South, the sacred harp singing is declining and singings are being called off or getting much smaller.
I'd like to invite you all to come sing with us in Portland, Oregon.
I confess I came here with preconceptions. I mean, this part of the country is a bloody history, and if I'm honest, I expected to have my stereotypes of white Bible Belt America reinforced. But I'm struck by how non-judgmental everyone is, how open they've been to people of different religious, political, and even sexual persuasions. And when everyone turns for home, we're invited back to one of the singers' houses for something to eat, drink, and of course, more song.
It is certainly indie music. Money hardly changes hands. It's all it takes to have a sacred harp singing is songbooks and voices and food. But food and locations are provided sort of reciprocally. And it is so totally different from today's idea of music or musical sound as a commodity is bought and sold.
The singing is over, for today anyway. But page 80 is open from the book, and it's called the Shouting Song, and it goes, "Shout, O glory, sing, glory, hallelujah, I'm going where pleasure never dies." I've never lost that pleasure when I sing, and neither have these people. There's an infectious enthusiasm around sacred harp which appears to cross divides. The original communities may face a real challenge in passing on the tradition, but it's reassuring that people everywhere are seeking the intangible rewards of singing together.
She sang that loud and clear.
You can sing loud, you can't sing all that.
Songs of the Sacred Harp was presented by Kerris Matthews and produced by Joby Waldman. It was a Something Else production for BBC Radio 4.